The listener can't see this, but Arthur is smoking probably the longest cigarette I've ever seen in my life. And it's weird. He's leaning against a piano. It's all very strange.
The New Brunswick Archaeology Podcast, featuring your hosts, Gabe Reinick and Ken Holyoke.
Welcome back to the Brunswick Archaeology Podcast. I'm Gabe Reinick in a spring-like Fredericton, New Brunswick, and I'm joined, as I am just about every fortnight, by Ken Holyoke in his longest hallway in the world office in Lethbridge, Alberta. How are you, Ken?
Very best. It's also spring-like here, which means it's very windy, but it is warm. I will take the wind with a little bit of warmth over the minus 20 or so.
And is it just warm because your computer is currently on fire?
Yeah. So the listener, I don't know. Well, they'll hear this maybe later in the episode. There's going to be a bit brief pause where partway through our interview with the University of New England students and faculty on their Time Team New England podcast. My computer sent up a rather concerning alarm that said I had essentially run out of disk space. So it's the burning smell has subsided for right now. I've put out the smoke and so we're just going to get a new hard drive in there just for safety's sake.
Yes. The listener can't see, but Ken looks a little alarmed, right?
Yeah. There are files that are backed up on the cloud, but there are also files on this computer that, need to not disappear.
And we've got a pretty exciting episode lined up for the listener tonight, where it's going to be, I think, the first time we've ever done a podcast about a podcast.
Podcast about a podcast and an interview with people in studio.
That's right.
In a real studio.
So we're going to be, it was very impressive. It was a whole group of people in a studio, and those people were from the University of New England, and they were plugging their new podcast, which we'll be discussing, which was made in a History 399 class at the University of New England. It's called By the Wayside. But before we get to that, Ken, the listener may have noticed that we have expanded somewhat here. We're not even just doing New Brunswick archaeology anymore. We're not even just doing Maine archaeology anymore. We're doing cultural criticism, really, of things about Maine archaeology.
We'll see where you're going with this.
I just was commenting on the broad purview of our program.
Yes, we do have a much broader perspective. We've gone all the way to the muskeg of northern Alberta last week and places in between.
Yeah, exactly. But one of the challenges that's presented, Ken, I think possibly to our reach, and we're happy with our reach. We think we've got, honestly, probably just about anyone who's interested in New Brunswick archaeology must be listening to this twice based on the metrics.
The listenership numbers, yeah.
Yeah, but the listener might have noticed that we're still, despite that, called the New Brunswick Archaeology Podcast. And we've wondered a little bit if it wouldn't make some sense to have a new name for this podcast. Isn't that right, Ken?
That's right, yep. It's always welcome. We still haven't hit that perfect one yet, though.
Yeah, and if the listener did have a new name for this podcast, where would they send it if they weren't going to do it on a note card taped to a bottle of Balvenie Scotch?
They would send that to newbrunswickarchaeology@gmail.com. That's New Brunswick Archaeology, all one word. Archaeology spelled ARCHAEOLOGY. newbrunswickarchaeology@gmail.com.
That's right. And if a name did come into that email account that we thought was suitable, yeah, not just suitable, but ideal, really, for this podcast, we would never just steal the information of one of our listeners. We wouldn't just take that. We would want to make sure that they were well compensated and rewarded for their efforts. And, well, Ken, as I mentioned, tonight we've got a truly excellent show planned for the listener. And keeping with the theme of tonight's program, Arthur Anderson and Eric Zulu have agreed to provide the lucky listener who renames this podcast with a special shore dinner for the aforementioned lucky listener and five of his or her friends. The whole thing's going to unfold at the campus of the University of New England, right where the Willows, the shore dinner hall you're about to learn about, was. And now, of course, it's the lawn of the Kerry Hall at the University of New England beside a pretty creepy statue that's made of chicken wire and beach cobbles. But listener, Arthur and Eric are going to transport you to another time. A time before antibiotics. A time when life expectancy was 48. A time when there were 45, not 50, or perhaps 51, depending on when this airs, states. And when the butter never tasted better. So listen, this excursion is going to begin at 7 p.m., that's right, post-meridian, aboard an exact replica of the appropriately named steamship Portland, which you, lucky listener, are going to meet in Boston. And it's really a beautiful craft, Ken. It's made to the exact original 1889 standards at 281 feet, that's 8,600 Zorkian bloits long. She's a wooden-hulled side-wheel steamer, and once you're on the inside, Ken, well, it's just lovely. It's got gold trim, velvet carpet, and Ken, the good news about a replica is that unlike the original, this one is less likely to sink, which the Portland One did on December 27th, 1898, during the Portland Gale. And according to Wikipedia, at some point during the storm, Portland sank off Cape Ann with all hands, the exact number of which cannot be determined, as the only known passenger list went down with the ship. And as you know, Ken, this makes it virtually impossible to calculate in MNI, which you would do by taking all the hands and dividing by two. Okay, so the next morning, what's going to happen here is you're going to pull in, unsunk, into Portland, Maine, where Arthur and Eric are going to be waiting for you in a Model A runabout to take you on the journey to Biddeford. The good news, of course, is the roads have improved. The bad news is that you're going to be doing 28 miles an hour, 24.2 knots, on I-295 and I-95 while sitting in the back of a car that only has a front seat.
Well, but 28 miles an hour is actually not that slow.
No, but it will be on the modern turnpike.
Right, right.
Yes, it'll be probably a little scary. and I don't think it has airbags either. It doesn't say. But so in the back, though, Ken, where there is no seat, but where we might expect there to be a seat on a more modern vehicle, do you know what you're going to be sitting on, Ken? And what you're going to be sitting on is a giant cooler. And that's because before you book it for the turnpike, Arthur and Eric are going to be swinging by the Harbor Fish Market, where you've been before, Ken, for jumbo shrimps, Gulf of Maine scallops, clams, pounds of mussels, and Dodgeco, Flying Point, Glidden Point, John's River, Mare Point, Nuremberg, Pemaquid, Winter Point, Naughty Sisters, Saltwind, Royal River, Scruffy Cove, Arrows, Wave Riders, Butterfield, Chabig Island, Base of Del Mar, Love Point, Madeline Point, and Mookie Blue Oysters, not to mention an ice-cold magnum of Courvoisier and a handle of Allen's Coffee Brandy. But that's not all, Ken. Do you know what else is going in that cooler?
It's got to be a bag of chicken lobsters.
That's right, Ken. It's chicken lobsters. And would you like to explain this phenomenon to our listener?
So for those of you who are New Brunswick born, the chicken lobster is the main version of what we would canner. And so this is a lobster that's generally under a pound and a quarter, I think, is the cutoff. And I think that actually canners, they're not allowed to sell them anymore in New Brunswick, or not allowed to catch them or something like that. There's some rule that you can't get canners anymore. And I think that the term comes from that they were small enough that they were the lobsters that were separated out and put into canned lobster. But the fishmonger at the market that we went to there was incredulous when I talked about these, and she let out a large guffaw and handed me a bag of chicken lobsters.
That's right. That's right. And so, okay, Ken, so the trip to Biddeford is going to take, even at full throttle in the Ford, about an hour. And the annoying thing about the UNE campus is that we're going to have to sort of putter around for their 15 or 20 minutes while Arthur and Eric try to find parking. And one of the real problems with the Model A runabout is that because there's no rear view mirror, there's actually going to be nowhere to hang the parking pass. So we're probably just going to get a ticket anyway. But once we park the entire UNE history 399 class is going to appear as if by magic in lounge suits to show us around. And now, Ken, it may have occurred to you that with all of this, it's still only about lunchtime. So in true Maine fashion, Arthur and Eric have arranged for the lucky listener to enjoy ham Italians at the UNE site, where they'll offer an insightful lecture with illuminated slides about Champlain's description of an indigenous village right there at the mouth of the Saco River. And then we've got a real treat, Ken, cocktail hour. Do you know what other Maine-related ship sank in 1898?
I don't.
That would be the USS Maine, which exploded in Havana Harbor while protecting American interests during the Cuban War of Independence. It either got blown up by a mine or things got a little too hot in the coal room. Either way, the recipe for that drink, which is, I have to say, delicious, is a half teaspoon of absinthe, 2 ounces of rye whiskey, 3/4 ounces of sweet vermouth, and 2 teaspoons of Hering cherry liqueur, and we're going to garnish that with a branded cherry. And once we've polished off a few of those, Ken, do you know what time it is, Ken? It's going to be aperitivo time.
Oh, excellent.
And, And Arthur and Eric have cooked up a lovely traditional Maine cocktail for us to enjoy while they prepare a shore dinner. And that cocktail is a classic Maine delight that's called a burnt trailer. It's one part Allen's Coffee Brandy and two parts Moxie. And the lucky listener will be enjoying those while snacking on some sardines and saltines and watching Arthur and Eric cook, of course. Oh, and I almost forgot to mention the music. We've arranged for a gramophone to be set up right there on campus and for a series of wax cylinders to be available to provide the lucky listener with not just a sensory journey, but an auditory one. So that will be belting out hits like The Amorous Goldfish, and I Guess I'll Have to Telegraph My Baby. And then, Ken, it's dinner time, and I can practically smell the butter melting already. The lucky listener is going to be treated to the aforementioned seafood, that's right, even the steamers, boiled alive in their tender little shells, their screams filling the gentle sea breeze. And that seafood spread is going to be accompanied by corn on the cob, also slathered in butter. In fact, everything is going to be slathered in butter until we get to dessert. That's right, lucky listener. For dessert, the lads are prepping a special blueberry pie. The crust is practically 90% lard, the rest is butter, made in Griswold cast iron skillets, carefully restored to their former glory by Arthur himself, and topped with a healthy portion of Maine's favorite Gifford's ice cream. And that's going to be accompanied by an espresso martini made with 22 vodka Carabasset Coffee Company espresso, Maine maple syrup, and you guessed it, 4 ounces of Allen's Coffee Brandy. At this point, Ken, the lucky listener might be wondering any number of things. Among them, where am I? How did I get here? Who am I? Well, Ken, that's why we've scheduled part of this whole experience to take place on a campus of what is now a medical school. At least half of those students were EMTs in college just to try to nail the entrance exams. And look, the rest of them will be happy to look at you and ask if you'd snuggled an armadillo and gotten a bit of leprosy lately. Nonetheless, at the appointed moment, they will emerge holding an L.L. Bean Wicked Plus throw to load the lucky listener and friends onto to return them to the Model A and get them on their way back to the Lincoln Hotel, which is a converted mill that recently received a Michelin key right there in Biddeford.
Oh, wow.
Now, Ken, I could go on and on about this experience, but I think at this point the lucky listener can already smell the butter, feel the pop of the oysters on the tongue, and taste the coffee brandy in that burny part of their noses. So where would the lucky listener send their new names for this podcast to win a once-in-a-lifetime experience at the mouth of the Saco River?
Well, they would be sending that to newbrunswickarchaeology@gmail.com. That's New Brunswick Archaeology, all one word. Archaeology spelled ARCHAEOLOGY, newbrunswickarchaeology@gmail.com. You can also find us on Instagram. You can do a hashtag or a throw out or DM us at new_Brunswick_archaeology. You can also visit us on the web at newbrunswickarchaeology.com.
That's right. Ken, if you look in that mailbag, what do we have in the mailbag tonight?
So we don't have a ton of mail. We do have somebody who was a late entry to the book draw. So Tim, sorry, we got that in after we made the draw. For sending in, we've got some fresh new stickers, Tim. So if you are send us your address, we will make sure that you get some of the New Brunswick Archaeology 50th episode spectacular gold stickers have arrived today from our new Canadian distributor for stickers, Jukebox, whose swag presentation is far exceeds anything that the MAGA distributor did before. So
Ken is surrounded by tissue paper that I believe they wrapped it quite nicely.
Very nicely. These like very sturdy box, nice colors. I got some nice Jukebox tissue paper. So we've got a fresh tranche of 3-inch stickers, and in both the original New Brunswick Archaeology podcast design and our 50th episode spectacular, the golden anniversary New Brunswick Archaeology stickers, and then
that's right, we've got trad and we've got gold lame.
Exactly. So and then beyond that, this is a very old communication that I actually had not come across. I didn't realize that Google sorts our emails a little bit differently. And I clicked on the social tab, which I had not been looking at before. And I discovered that we've had a real increase in our YouTube subscriptions. And I'm actually not sure what we're up to now, but I should check that briefly here. But I wanted to say thank you to Officer Hampton, who sent in a couple of suggestions for names. This was back in July of 2023. So this is an almost 2-year-old comment on our YouTube channel.
Well, thank you.
And it says, okay, you asked for podcast name suggestions. Archaeology Now, Compositional Analytical Palooza, Dig in New Brunswick, Excavate This.
Is this all one name?
No, these are different ones. They're separated by exclamation points. So I'm giving some emphasis here. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Archaeology, or just plain old artifacts. So,
all right.
Thank you, Officer Hampton, for those suggestions.
Thank you, Officer Hampton. Yeah. And thank you for tuning in.
Yeah, we've taken them into consideration. And because it was so late in getting to your into your contribution, you're actually going to be eligible for this amazing package in Biddeford.
That's right. We will take we'll take it under consideration.
Yeah, yeah. So
the our error could be your game.
Exactly, exactly. But that's it for the mailbag right now.
All right. Well, thank you. And we always enjoy getting listener mail. And so, Ken, I think we're about ready to go to the main event now. But we should say there's not going to be a hit piece today because essentially the whole show is a hit piece, and that hit piece. Which you will hear about and which we will put in the show notes, is the podcast that the folks at UNE's HIS 399 course have put together. So I think without further ado, maybe we'll just hand it over to the UNE folks.
Yeah, yeah. So thank you, listener. And we will talk to you in a fortnight. We got some exciting episodes coming up here. And Gabe, I think the next time we're going to talk, you're going to be back from vacation. Is that correct?
I'll be back from vacation.
Yeah, just fresh as a daisy.
Fresh as a daisy. That's
excellent.
Right.
All right. Talk to you soon, listener, and enjoy the show.
Talk to you soon, listener. Today, we're joined by Eric Zullo and Arthur Anderson and members of their team-taught HIS 399 class at the University of New England in Biddeford for something we haven't done before, and that's a podcast about a podcast. The podcast and accompanying blog, called By the Wayside, follows the class's archaeological and archival efforts to identify a building that appeared in some early photographs of St. Francis College, which is now part of the University of New England. The documentary-style podcast includes a description of the archaeological work, interviews with historians and descendants of people associated with the building, and all done with narration by the class. I binge-listened to this a few weeks ago, and I highly recommend it to listeners of the New Brunswick Archaeology Podcast, and I understand it will be appearing on the typical podcast services soon, the kinds that you listen to this podcast on, but in the meantime, you can access the audio and the blog at sites.une.edu/UNEPAST, that's UNEPAST, all one word, sites.une.edu/UNEPAST, and we'll also put a link in the show notes.
Good.
So welcome, everyone, to the podcast. I thought maybe we just begin so the listener can get a sense of what you sound like, because me saying your name won't help at all. If we could just start with Kai and go around and have you each say your name.
Yeah, welcome to the podcast. And before you guys get started, you'll notice that their audio is probably going to be better than our audio because on top of this being a podcast about a podcast, this is the first time we've interviewed anybody who's in a studio, like a real studio.
It's pretty spiffy.
That's right. So, Kai, can we start with you?
Yeah. Hi, I'm Kai, and I'm really excited to be here. Thank you.
Thank you. And Marissa?
Hi, I'm Marissa.
Thanks for joining us, Marissa. And Peyton.
Hey, everyone. My name is Peyton.
And then thank you very much, Peyton. And then Arthur, who's no stranger to the New Brunswick Archaeology Podcast.
No, but I'm a stranger to sounding this clear on it.
It's true. It's true. And then Eric.
Yeah, I'm not sure you've ever sounded this clear just in person. It's remarkable. I'm Eric.
Thank you, Eric. The listener can't see this, but Arthur is smoking probably the longest cigarette I've ever seen in my life. And it's weird. He's leaning against a piano. It's all very strange. So
it's the smoking jacket is what's really getting me. It's not. And the fez. Where do you even buy a fez?
On the internet, Eric.
He looks like a very young Shriner. So I thought maybe we could just start a little bit by saying what your podcast was about. And so it was a class project, and it focused on two buildings near now what is now DeCary Hall at the University of New England in Biddeford. And your listeners, when they visit your podcast, are going to know these buildings as the Willows and the Wayside. And people who visit the UNE campus now will know this location because it's got that extremely strange chicken wire and rock sculpture of a kind of, I think, a person sort of hunched over with all those rocks held together by chicken wire. But why'd you become interested in these buildings and in that location?
Well, I guess I'll start. I was a department chair, and I had been regularly visiting the dean's office, as one does in that position. And they used to have this picture up there. I had just started teaching some environmental history courses, and I was immediately struck by the fact that there's a pond in the picture where there's a parking lot now. And I was kind of struck by that. And then as I looked closer, I saw this house that isn't there anymore because we have our chicken wire rock structure. And I became very, very curious about what this building was and what it had been and why it was there and why it wasn't there now and where the pond had gone and you know, all of these sort of questions. And at about that same time, because I was teaching some environmental history, I'd had Arthur come in to talk about the earliest history of this campus and his work down near our marine sciences building. And we got to talking about what it would mean to try and explore this house archaeologically and historically, and what we might do together to uncover that and to explore the different disciplinary assumptions, I guess, that we have as historians and so forth. And as he started coming into my classes to talk about his work, we found in our classes we were having conversations about history and archaeology and what that meant. And so it seemed like something to talk about.
That's great. We should say, Eric, you're a historian.
I am.
And what do you study primarily?
I'm a historian of modern Europe. My specialty is actually the history of tourism and also cool. National identity. So then the interplay of those two things.
Cool. What was your perspective, Arthur, on the origins of this project? And tell us about sort of when Eric first had you come in.
It was a lot of fun to start talking to students who are thinking about the past in some different ways and start to parse those differences between, I mean, I think for a lot of people, archaeology and history are kind of interchangeable because they're about the past. And so we had a lot of conversations that ended up being sort of structured around methodology, which was a surprisingly fun thing, at least for us, to talk to students about. And Eric had been looking at the much more recent history and environmental history of our campus. And I'd been looking more deeply into the past and was kind of struck by, for all that I was losing sleep over what was there 3,000 years ago, what was there in 1952 was not really on my radar at all. So thinking about some of those transitions on what turns out to be a really sort of interesting landform, interesting cultural and ecological place in the landscape with the river and nearby Biddeford Pool and a lot of different things going on. So I got really excited about kind of getting further back through archival records to think about what this landscape was, and going back to 1800, that's a couple hundred years after some of the areas we're looking at archaeologically. So there's this historical record stretching from the present back to almost touch some of the archaeology we're doing. And that ended up being really interesting. So the opportunity to get together some enthused students and see if we could get away with digging some holes and trying to make a class out of this was pretty exciting. And so we put in a proposal to be able to team teach this, which they ended up, at least that time, letting us do. And it was a fantastic experience for everyone involved. I mean, I think we all learned a lot. And one of the things about team teaching it, and I know the students may agree or disagree with this, but it made the project feel much more collaborative because we were all working on something original together and we were all learning from each other.
Yeah. And you definitely get a group of enthused students because the listener in the first episode will pick up. I can't remember who said it, but somebody was incredibly excited about finding nails. I think that you really want to encourage any student who is going to be out on a project with you who's very excited about finding nails, because that has not been my experience. And so so Kai and Marissa and Peyton, I guess kind of flipping the same question to you guys, what's your perspective on how did you guys become interested in this other than it's a course requirement, sort of your engagement with making the podcast and exploring this past through both the field and the studio on the project?
I got to do the class. I took Arthur's Plagues and Populations class the semester before and realized that my childhood love for archaeology, anthropology, I should actually do more of that. So when I saw the class was being offered, I'd always wanted to do archaeology, and it ended up being one of, if not the best class that I've ever taken on this campus. Due to the team teaching.
Did you hear that, Dean?
Yes. It would be amazing to offer again. So many students need to take it. Please. But it was such a unique experience. Like we've said before, it made us feel like professionals. We had a lot of collaborative time. The whole project was collaborative with students and professors. We got to do whatever we wanted. So if somebody was interested in getting knees deep into the pits, basically, they could do that. If somebody just wanted to observe and take notes, they could do that. Sifting, everybody had their individual role that we all just kind of fell into, which was a really unique experience as well. And then same thing in the archives. We did some independent research and then got together with people who were interested in the same things that we were in order to create the podcasts that you guys listen to.
Great. And so that was Marissa, listener, just in case you didn't immediately identify the voice, despite the excellent studio quality sound we're getting. And so I wondered if perhaps Kai or Peyton could tell us, and we're being careful to not completely spoil the podcast for the listener, because we think they would really enjoy listening to it. Just what time period does this podcast consider? And aside from the mystery of the Willows, what's kind of the social context of Biddeford at the time your research was considering?
Well, I mean, my episode was mostly just on the family that built the houses. So, I mean, that time period is like mid-1800s up to like, I think the latest we went was 1930s-ish, when kind of as far up as we know that they were in those houses. So that was the time period I was mostly looking at.
Yeah, I was kind of whatever came before. So basically Ice Age up to Industrial Revolution of Biddeford.
That's operating in a much larger time scale than
yeah.
So for the listener, when you listen through the four episodes, they're following a chronology, and it's kind of interesting because they're all around the same length, but they get sort of compressed. The time that they cover sort of compresses each time with a little bit more sort of detail in the historical reference, and you get to know sort of at contextualized Biddeford broadly down to like meeting people basically and kind of getting very intimate with a few members of a family group basically and some sort of, I don't know, some Biddeford politics back in the day, I think would be a polite way of saying it. I don't know. Is choking somebody's talking crow a political issue or?
Well, and a particularly ornery crow. I mean, let's face it, Pompey had some issues.
So what are these two houses? What's going on in them? In some ways, it's 13,000 years of shore dinners is the topic of the podcast. But these particular houses have a kind of unique history that I think the listener might not be aware of was a thing. It's kind of a unique cultural phenomenon.
Not it.
I mean, based on what we were looking at and researching, shore dinner halls were surprisingly common in the Biddeford area, especially where UNE is now. There was multiple competing shore dinner halls, and multiple waysides, which was very fun for our research. But it really just seemed like it was a really big community place. There was bowling teams that came by, different church events, and they all would just gather at these different shore dinner halls and have little meetings all the time and publicized in the newspapers. That's how we found a lot of our information was just advertising, hey, this weekend, shore dinner hall, come be there. The bowling team's going to be there. Or, oh, they ate like five lobsters. The guy said it was amazing. And all the fun exaggeration in those early.
Yeah, I think kind of to our sense of things, the boundaries between a private residence and a commercial establishment were pretty fuzzy. So this was a farm and a place of business for people that were fishing, but also you could stop by for a lobster dinner or host a big event. And I think that had a lot to say about the community and how some of the lines drawn between those things were in different places than we'd see them today.
Yeah, like I thought these like shore dinner halls. So I was not familiar with what a shore dinner hall was until kind of listening to this podcast, and sort of I've been Googling about them just out of fascination, and thinking that I feel like I would really love to go attend a shore dinner hall and get, you know, oysters and clam bake and lobsters for like 75 cents or something like that.
The menus are pretty spectacular.
And kind of so in terms of the social context in which those are, like, what's going on in Biddeford at that time that and maybe sort of brought more broadly in Maine, because there's sort of this interesting story. And again, we don't want to give away too much, but these shore dinner halls become a thing and then sort of disappear in relation to kind of the rising industrialization and changes in Biddeford and Maine more generally, eh?
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to step on the toes of a historian of modern tourism, but we see a bit, it's an industrial shift as the center of the community moves upriver towards the falls. And then the community at the mouth of the river that's a little bit left behind by the need for this industrial power is kind of reinventing themselves, which I'll let Eric say more about.
Yeah, I mean, so you end up getting a couple of different things happening. So now you've got a class of people who are more affluent because industrialization means that things are cheaper. They can buy more. They have they're exercising. They're functioning on clock time. So, you know, their days are kind of metered out. They have more time to spend. It's the beginnings of automobility. So people can now travel cheaply and efficiently via car. Well, not cheaply at this point, I guess. It's cheaper by the end of our story than it is at the beginning, because the Model T comes along. And so you have a growing leisure class on one side. And then on the other side, you have a place that was a farming fishing community that was downtown Biddeford. And then downtown moves up river to the falls, to the factories, essentially, and the population moves up there. And the people who are left living in the old downtown now have to figure out how they're going to live. What are they going to do? How are they going to make a living? Well, hey, we've got this large new leisured class that we can start to serve by giving them food.
And so the listener will detect here that Eric and Arthur are sort of good at riffing right now. And one of the things that they do in the podcast is they provide a certain amount of blog discussion, so written discussion, but they also contextualize some of the episodes. And one of the things that I thought I detected early on in the show was that Arthur and Eric seem to be having a little bit of a kind of epistemological crisis. And it seemed in some ways to me that what this podcast was about, that archaeologists know things in different ways that historians know things. So I'm kind of curious if anyone would care to comment on the ways that the documentary and interview evidence was sometimes in tension with the archaeological record on the one hand, but then also sometimes very kind of complementary. And I sort of felt like in many ways you all were working through this as the episodes unfold.
I think one of the most interesting questions is around specificity. I don't know. Here's where I might get sort of less good at riffing on my own crisis. But the knowns and the unknowns, even when they weren't in contradiction, didn't actually articulate. So we can talk to someone who remembers being in the building, but we're still not 100% sure where it was. You know, so there's some scraps of foundation and we're trying to kind of figure out what was over here and where was the front door and how is it pointing. But at the same time, we're having a conversation with someone who remembers the seniors partying there when it was a dorm. There's levels of detail and levels of certainty that don't quite match up. And that struck me as really interesting because I'm so used to dealing. I mean, as a proto-historic and occasional amateur historic archaeologist, I suppose I would have said that I had a familiarity with the tension between the historical record, but Champlain's journal is different from a newspaper article from when your father was alive and talking to someone who actually remembers the thing you're digging up. And I think that also led to some interesting reflections on ephemerality. And as an archaeologist, I'm the assumption that we're trying to find out things that are hard to find out because it was a long time ago and we don't really know is one that we're pretty used to. So we're digging up something that's 3,000-4,000 years old. Of course it's going to be hard to, you know, find this information, figure out what's going on. But actually, if we're digging up something that people remember within their lifetime, but we still have surprisingly big questions about it, that really shows you how quickly cultural landscapes and memory disappears, which I thought was an interesting reflection from the work.
I'm used to going into archives. I mean, I'll start with a hypothesis. I'll start with a question, and I start finding answers. Well, I hopefully do. Hopefully there's documents that give me those answers. And then I don't usually need to completely revise everything about what I'm thinking. And yet the experience of archaeology for me was totally different, because we'd go out and we'd think, aha, we've figured it out. We found this, finally, yay. And then we would find out shortly thereafter that no, actually we hadn't found it. What we'd found was totally different. And we'd have to completely revise how we were reading what we were finding in the ground. And it was a constant experience of whiplash. I don't know how you guys do it.
That's actually the statue that's in front of DeCary Hall. That's why he's slumped over. That's actually an unhappy archaeologist who's just had a very difficult day. Yeah.
This is not the foundation you were looking for.
Yeah.
It gives a whole new meaning. Yes. It makes sense now.
Would any of the students care to chime in on this? Did any of the students have thoughts about the kind of different ways or how this jived with previous experiences you maybe had in other classes?
I guess.
Did you guys have archaeological experience before taking this class?
In my dreams. Yeah.
My only archaeological adjacent thing was going to my Nana's house that was built in the 1700s and finding things that she tried to throw away and be like, whoa, that's so cool. She's like, oh, don't pay attention to that. I need to throw that away. That's like your grandfather's wine bottle that used to hide in the stone walls. And I'm like, okay.
I mean, I was really into ancient Egypt as a kid, but that's about as much experience.
I think all three of us have maybe not secret love for Egyptology, but.
Mm-hmm. So one thing I was wondering, so you're all science students, right? Yeah. So one of the things that I've noticed in teaching is that students in science majors will often come in and they want there to be an answer. And in this class, answers were often kind of hard to come by. I mean, we came to something at the end, but you know, that whiplash thing was real. What was that like for you coming out of, you know, maybe a very different experience in other classes?
I was going to say, I've been doing biological research for 5 years now, pretty consistently. And I felt like it was pretty similar, because in that, a lot of my research there, I just expected not to work about half the time. So I was like, oh, we didn't find much today. I was like, cool, yeah, great. So when we did find something, it was like, great, it worked this time. Definitely there was some of the whiplash, but I don't think as much, because I'm used to, you know, this may not work, so we're going to have to troubleshoot what to do next.
That's right, listener. You heard it here first. It's just like shark DNA. That's what archaeology is like.
Exactly the same. Exactly the same.
So some of the listeners might be familiar with the UNE campus. I'm a little bit familiar with it. But I'm curious if you were to sort of tell, what were some things that surprised yourselves about as you learned about the UNE campus and about the history of the University of New England?
Well, I guess I'll start. I've been here since 2008. It's very pretty. I've always remarked on that. But even though, and this is probably, I shouldn't admit this, even though I'm a historian, I wasn't really thinking that it was different before. And so now it's very difficult to look at it and not see that difference, to not think about this as downtown Biddeford, to not think of this as one of the first places of white settlement, to not think of this place as being settled by people just after the last ice age, to not kind of think about the way all of that plays out and the way the landscape kind of reveals that much deeper story. And for me, at least, it makes it a much more exciting place. I love walking to class and looking over and going, yeah, there was a house there. That's cool. And I know the people who were there, and they had a talking crow that died a horrific death. And over there, that was where the house where the priests were first living was, and that's where the old meeting house, where the first meeting house was, and that's where the second meeting house was, and that's kind of enriched the place, I think.
That's great. Yeah, the crow will be on the stickers, I understand, when the podcast goes live.
I think it should be the new mascot.
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, there we go. Yeah. Did any of the students, did it change the way that you see the campus on your, you know, daily walks around?
I would say for sure, because as someone who didn't grow up in the area, I wasn't really familiar with how significant it was historically. So figuring out that all of the things I had learned in history class way down in the South, that I was standing on the land where it actually happened, and it's kind of startling because I'd never been anywhere old in the United States. So it definitely changed how I viewed like where we were.
Is it a bit of a flex with the other students that you can kind of walk around and give them a tour through the past? Is this like a, only the cool kids would do that, of course. But
does it make you cooler?
I used it as my fun fact for the icebreakers that they all make us go through during the first week of classes.
It's good to have one of those at the ready.
Yeah. It was like, what's
this? This is like if you ever end up on Jeopardy, you can talk about investigating a place where a talking crow was choked out, basically.
Yeah, all my friends love it. I was like, oh yeah, see that stat, like that weird statue? There was a house there. They'd be like, what? It's a great talking point. And then like for the icebreakers, I'd mentioned like, oh yeah, they're like, one cool thing you did last year. And I was like, oh yeah, just helped dig up foundations of a house, no big deal. But then nobody had, even though we put out signs, nobody had any idea and thought it was like so cool. I know that coming here, you know, St. Francis is a thing. You see like religious iconography here and there. And I'm like, oh yeah, this used to be a different place, but not like torn down houses and shore dinner halls and all that.
And St. Francis was the college that was there before it became the University of New England,
yeah.
Right?
Right.
Excellent.
Well, along the way,
I didn't want anyone to think St. Francis had actually come down.
You know,
he found out the crow had been roughed up, so St. Francis thought he'd fear.
I don't want to say that he didn't. I mean, there's the houses that we were digging, but even existing buildings. So we're in DeCary Hall now down in the basement, but we're in the 1948 wing of a building that was started in 1939. And looking at what's here now and thinking about how much smaller it was and what exactly its footprint was, that changes the way I interact with the place. Knowing that when I go up to the third floor of the building, I'm walking through old dorm space and that the strange bumps in the floor are part of the old sinks, it changes the experience of the place. Knowing something about the rules that people who were here in the 30s and 40s and 50s had to follow when they were living in those spaces changes things as well. I mean, we're not nearly as stringent about showering only once a week or what you must wear while in the shower. Or I don't know. I haven't lived in any of our dorms, but I don't think you have to be observed while you're showering, do you?
No, I think that's illegal now.
Yeah. And like kind of interesting tensions, like with the campus sort of being this kind of protective area for the expat French population, Quebecois population in Biddeford at the time. Like that's a totally, you know, that's a really interesting piece of some of the puzzle that you guys uncovered, and I really enjoyed that.
Yeah, I was fascinated to learn and going through some of the archives and yearbooks and brochures that St. Francis College put out that, I mean, even in the time of the building that we were talking about, some classes were still conducted in French here.
Yeah, that's cool. Neat. So, Eric, you're a historian of modern tourism, as you mentioned, which I have to say, it's probably one of those things that sounds more fun than it is. But
No. It's more fun than it sounds.
Oh, is that right?
Okay. Absolutely.
And in fact, you literally wrote the book on modern tourism, I understand. It's called A History of Modern Tourism. And has this project opened up any other areas of tourism research you're interested in Southern Maine? I was sort of curious about that as you were discussing, you know, kind of localish tourists coming in for these shore dinners and the boat trips they could take and that sort of thing.
Yeah, yeah. Well, so one of the things that really struck me about the class was how well the kind of a class-wide project worked. So we were all engaged in investigating something. I've certainly done research projects in classes, and I've done team projects in classes, producing podcasts, but not something where we were all sort of going into it. It wasn't that Arthur and I were entirely blind. We'd done a little bit of research beforehand, but intentionally not a lot. And so I'm interested in continuing to do that. One of the things about this area is it is a kind of leisure economy. Biddeford Pool is very much a summer vacation place. People come back year after year to stay. Fortune's Rocks also in this area is the same. And so I'm going to revise a modern tourism class that I teach, and we'll do a class project exploring the history of the area. Before that, though, I'm hoping Arthur and I will be able to do at least, may not be quite what we did this time, but something at least somewhat similar next fall. And so we're going to look at traffic on the Saco River. And so we'll look at the town dock here was one of the ferry terminals for the river. So we're hoping to do some digging there. And I believe that dock goes back to the first white settlers. So we should have some maybe 17th century archaeology there. The oldest building in Biddeford is one of these ferryman houses where ferries were docking. And so, you know, I think we can explore that as a group and then try and kind of create a story about how people moved up and down the river. So that'll be something we do this coming fall.
I'm getting a sense that we've put the hooks into you.
Oh.
Well, I wanted to be an archaeologist when I was a kid. I went around in my old neighborhood. I had digs. I wouldn't have called it a midden at the time, but I was digging in a midden. I found what turns out to be a valuable 7-Up bottle.
Oh, very cool.
So, you know, that's something.
So just on artifacts before we get too far away from things, I was fascinated by you guys being excited by nails. And so,
And clamshells.
So I guess my question to the students, like, what was something that you, found during the excavation that was particularly exciting? You know, what's your favorite nail? I mean, mine's rosehead, but that's just a bias of my part. You know,
I think in the test pits we were digging, probably one of the most exciting ones was we were about to kind of finish up with one of the pits. And then we found a huge chunk of like pottery, which we believe to be a piece of a sink. And then right next to it is a huge like rusted pipe that is still in the ground. So it was really interesting just to find that right next to each other as we were like, oh, we're going to be done with this pit pretty soon. Let's clean it up, finish it up. And then we found those. So
I think a big victory, me and Peyton worked together in order to unearth this little wood timber that was, I mean, not little in our whole sense, but but that was like a prize to get out of the earth in one piece. Of course, it's no longer in one piece after drying out, but that was such a reward.
They took that news really well.
Yeah, still cry about it.
Yeah.
Yeah, only in private.
They pretended to take that news really well.
Found a nice chunk of plate as well.
That wasn't in our pit.
Yeah, that was on the other side of the dig. Yeah.
I was excited about part of a doorway. That was very exciting to me because it started helping us actually position where the house was. And we went through various iterations of what it was we'd found and so forth. But I think in the end, it actually really helped us situate where the building had been.
Very cool.
Great. So any advice for faculty members who are thinking about including a podcast component in their courses, other than if they're interested in modern tourism or the fairly recent history of Biddeford, they should listen to yours?
Well, I would certainly advise them to have you guys come in and advise us on how to put together a podcast. I think that would be a first.
Yeah, that was helpful. Yeah, thanks.
Oh,
thanks
thank
for
you.
Coming in.
See, we should have gotten really meta and recorded that conversation so that we could have a podcast about a podcast about us telling you how to podcast.
That would be amazing.
Yep. Next time.
Emmanuel, if you could put in the time travel sound.
Yeah, it would be great. Noise right now. Yeah. Hitting light speed.
Here we are in a classroom. Be careful.
You just remember everything you said. You know?
Yeah.
I thought it was great. I mean, I enjoyed doing it, and I think the students did a great job. We were lucky to have some resources in terms of a recorder that and some equipment that allowed them to do that, which I think was ultimately really important to they sounded good, right? They sounded better than I usually do when I'm on this podcast and in my car or something. So it sounded pretty polished, and we were able to pull that off. But I wasn't completely sure we were going to be able to do. And I think it gave it was another way to do things, rather than writing a paper or something like that. So it was really interesting to sort of advise and supervise. I think there was a bit of I don't want to say a leap of faith on our part, but it's one thing, you can draft a paper with a student enough times. By the time they turn the final draft, you pretty much know what's coming. But there were some crossed fingers.
It was very nerve-wracking. Yeah. I mean, one of the things that was very striking about it was that it by necessity had to come together in the last couple of weeks of the semester. Yeah. We were still digging in archives and collecting some oral history and so forth, like 3 weeks from the end of term. And that meant we were still piecing together the stories to tell. And so when we finally came together to sort of map out what the episodes were going to look like and to kind of think about the narrative arc and to think about the format and so forth, there really wasn't much time, which was nerve-wracking for Arthur and I, and I'm just going to guess much more so for the students.
Probably a little bit, yeah.
So, I mean, how did that work for you guys? I mean, I know it was stressful. I mean, we've talked about that, but how did you kind of process the fact that you had to suddenly pull together 15-minute episodes on the fly, really?
I mean, for me, it was much nicer and it made way more sense to do it versus a final essay that's like, oh, just come compile your whatever you learned and do it basic essay format. Because we had done so much actual field and like digging and archival research, making a podcast in order to tell, like, educate the people made way more sense than just another essay that we've written a billion essays throughout our college careers. And even though it was really hard finding a space, a time that worked with everybody, I feel like everybody I've talked to felt really proud and thought it was a really cool experience, even though it was a little bit stressful. Having our little sections come together and create this giant project was a really nice way of finishing out the class.
Yeah, and you guys should be proud of it. It's like, it sounds excellent. Like, it's the production quality is very high. So that definitely, we'll have a link to it here. But as Gabe said, we would highly encourage our listeners. I think if you're listening to this podcast, you would get quite a bit of enjoyment out of this one, out of there.
If you like our podcast, you'll love their podcast.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. It even has production quality that goes beyond, like, we should really get a manual to kind of like do a little bit more, to get the emotional cues in there with the music. Oh. Right?
That's true. We could do that. And one of the other things that I actually kind of enjoyed about the podcast was it's kind of a documentary style podcast. So it's, and it kind of unfolds in that, sort of Ken Burns tempo that I enjoyed listening
glad
to
you
quite
noticed
a bit
that.
and mixed in with a bit of play by play commentary.
Well, maybe early Ken Burns. I mean, this was not like 9-hour episodes. So,
okay. Yeah. But thematic, right? I guess. it wasn't like if Ken had tried to do a documentary, podcast.
It really was amazing that it came together so well. I mean, because again, I can't emphasize enough how quickly everybody had to pull these things together, and then how well it gelled. The meetings, the editorial meetings we had, kind of mapping these things out, were at least as much fun for me. They were what I've always wanted to come out of these kind of podcast planning meetings when I've done it previously. And so even those meetings were, I mean, the digging and the archives, I mean, that was incredible. But those meetings, it was like sitting around a writer's table, I don't know, plotting the Simpsons or something. It was really fun, and the creativity and the willingness that students had to push back when they didn't think some idea that Arthur or I had made sense, because they had another idea in mind, and that, you know, meant that it was really their product, and super entertaining. I mean,
so it sounds like apart from a documentary about the making of your podcast for next year's version of this, what are the next steps for the project? And maybe, Arthur, sorry, I interrupted you there. Maybe you're getting to that or building on that.
Oh, no, I was just going to say, this may sound callous in front of the students, but I think that the time pressure, the real-world pressure of producing something that's not just going to get graded, but people are going to see it, and actually the time pressure and the way that forces you to make some decisions and sometimes bold decisions was good. And we really saw that when, you know, Eric and I came up with a few dumb ideas, and students were like, no, we're not going to do that. Great. I like that decisiveness. But yeah, in terms of next steps, I mean, I think, you know, finding some ways and working out how to do these things through university administrations and where facilities would or would not like us to dig a hole, and working with all of this within kind of a class schedule. Archaeologists will know doing this once a week is challenging, even when you have a 3-hour block. But I think there's some investigations that we'd like to continue and kind of keep some of this rolling. And we're also working on writing up, you know, we dug some holes, so we got to write reports for the university facilities and for the state. But we'd also like to kind of continue processing, thinking about this, and maybe write a little bit about the experience for other archaeologists and you know, understand that variations of archaeology on campus and thinking about ways to do that is kind of a conversation that a lot of places are having right now. And we'd welcome people getting in touch with questions about how this went or how we apply these things. So, yeah, we're thinking about, you know, both the information we're finding, but also sharing this experience and how this came together and what worked and what didn't, in hopes that, you know, more places have more ability to facilitate these kinds of experiences for students and for faculty.
Well, thank you all so much for coming on to the program. We really appreciate it. I really enjoyed the podcast. And so thank you, Kai Watkins, Marissa Carter, Peyton Stevens, and thank you, Arthur and Eric. And thank you, Janelle Stafford, who I understand is in studio with you, making Arthur sound particularly dulcet today. And I highly recommend to all of our listeners your podcast, which you can access currently at sites.une.edu/unepast. And we'll also place a link to that in the show notes so you can find it. I hope you all enjoy that and all check it out. Thank you so much for joining us to discuss your project.
Thanks everybody. Yes, it was nice to meet you. It was fun. Eric, and nice to meet you, Kai and Marissa and Peyton. And thanks for coming on.
Nice to meet you too.
Yeah. Thank you. This was fun as always.
Thanks a lot.